It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client,
Mama Monster,
conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
You know, as soon as tickets went on sale for the Ring of Honor New Japan G1 Supercard, I made sure that I had my ticket locked in. I don't know what the card is going to look like by the time April rolls around. I suspect there's a very good chance that the Bucks and Kenny Omega and that whole crew are not going to be on that show. But the chance to see Okada and those guys wrestling in the Garden for the first time was just too good to pass up. I did so, though, knowing that that meant I'd have to miss the NXT TakeOver show on that same night. I've been to many, many TakeOver shows. I have yet to see a bad one, so I'm sure this one's going to be no different. But I was, you know, I was bummed about that because I was missing out on a sure thing for something that isn't so sure. And alas, WWE has decided to bump TakeOver back by one night to Friday and shift the Hall of Fame to Saturday, which was the old format. That was the old schedule they used to go by. It used to be TakeOver on Friday, Hall of Fame on Saturday, and then WrestleMania. And then a couple of years ago, they changed it. So they've gone back to, as a WWE rep said, they've gone back to better serve the fans by altering the schedule. I applaud them for whatever their real intention was for the move, because I don't think they just woke up one day and said, hey, this is unfair to all the fans who want to go to both shows, so we'll move TakeOver to a different night. I tend to not think they just woke up one day and decided to make that decision, but whatever their ulterior motive is here, it was the right move to make for the fans. And it's not like they were having trouble moving TakeOver tickets because of the MSG show, just because it sold out. They were going to have a packed house anyway, so whatever their reason was, this is a good move for the fans. I applaud them for it. That means that I get to see both shows now that weekend, and I've already got my NXT tickets secured, so I'll be at both shows. And yeah, I'm happy about that. See? Wrestling can be fun. It could also not be fun. And I can tell you when it's not fun, and I can tell you when it's trash. Like it was last Monday night. I can walk and chew gum at the same time. Unfortunately, this is a foreign concept to Xavier Woods. You didn't think I wasn't going to address what he had to say this week, did you? Oh, I'm going to get to him. Don't you worry. This is episode 575 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, December 2nd, 2018. I am the Sala Monster. We begin the month of December offering you guys the same deal that we have been offering now for some time through Audible. They've been very kind to extend this offer out here to all of you for a 30-day trial of the Audible service and one free audiobook of your choosing. As part of that trial, all you need to do is sign up using the link audibletrial.com/Salamonster. And when you sign up for the trial through that link, you can sample it for a month, get to pick any book that you want. There's a lot of really good wrestling books up there, as you guys know. Bob Holly, Justin Roberts, Daniel Bryan. I think Shawn Michaels has a book up there. Chris Jericho's second book is up there, which I think is one of the better ones that he's done. Hulk Hogan, if you like, from the fiction section. Brock Lesnar's got a book up there. So audibletrial.com/Salamonster. And even if you cancel the trial in those 30 days, the book belongs to you. So go ahead and sign up there. And for those of you, there are a couple people who asked me if the Lyft offer is still available. It is, and it will be for quite a while. So if you are interested in signing up for a Lyft account, I mean, I have Lyft and Uber both on my phone, so you know I can check sometimes to see which one has the better price than the other. But I use Lyft primarily, and it's a really good service. It works for me, you know, here in New York. So sign up for a Lyft account and use the code, the promo code Salamonster. And what that does, it gets me a couple of bucks off my next ride, not as much as you may think, but it will also get you money off your first ride. So when you finally take that first ride after you signed up for your new account, I've heard from different people it's $5 off, it could be $10 off your first ride, but you're going to get money off your first ride. So use the code Salamonster and you can get a discount on us. And also, you can make a PayPal donation on thesolemonster.com. Right-hand side of the page, you will see the button. If you so choose to do so, that is the place to go. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on the show. Thank you to all of our PayPal VIPs from this past week. We had a whole bunch of them, including the Baltimore Baller, Trey Parker. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Out of Control Cody Thomas, The Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, The Portland Pop Star Paul Hamilton, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Luis Hercules Hernandez, Yvonne Bruiser Balak, Killshot Keith Hart, Eugene Crazy Eyes Morgan, Pull No Punches Alan Ragasa. What's up, Alan? Happy birthday to him. The Malaysian Mastermind, Samuel T. Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard. We have Luck is for Losers, Lance Flint, Stephen Handyman, Halistic, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. You know, by the way, Stephen is such a handyman. I respect the hell out of his great talents as a handyman, but not even he can fix that Raw from last Monday. We have Robert Murray, the Velvet Revolver, Handsome Harold White, Grimlock Garrick Booker, Beth Memphis Maniac Small, Quick Draw Benjamin Quesnel, the Harley Davidson, Juan Diaz, the Vegas Vigilante, Mohammed Taib Ibrahim. And last but not least here, I got to mention our good friend, the Black Buck, Matt Harrigan. He is hosting his annual Super Kick the Holidays fundraiser. I've promoted this in the past. It's for a good cause. This year, they're hoping to raise $3,000 in donations. They're going to be purchasing food, clothing, toys, wrestling gear for homeless families, veterans, hospitalized children all across the New York City area. Matt does a great job with this. They are tax exempt, and so donations of $70 or more can be written off. They also support employer matching, which you can do right there directly on their website. Just visit www.superkickfoundation.org/STH4, Superkick the Holidays 4. And you can go to the website there and contribute. You can also follow them on Twitter at SuperkickFNDN. Definitely support that great cause. Hey, Tony Kresser, forgot to mention Tony. Thank you for the kind words you left in iTunes this week. I very much appreciate that. And before I get into, and I am going to very briefly talk about Raw, I'll try anyway not to spend too much time on it, but Raw, SmackDown, I did check out both championship matches on the two episodes of NXT UK this week, which was a lot of fun, and I've got a bunch of other things to talk about as well, including this week we are at number 9 on the countdown of the top 10 greatest Royal Rumble Championship matches in history. Last week, we started the countdown with number 10. And we're, you know, these are ranked. We're counting backwards down to number 1. Each of the next, I guess it would be 9 weeks now, until the 2019 Royal Rumble. The first match in the countdown at number 10 was Dean Ambrose against Kevin Owens in a last man standing match for the Intercontinental Championship at 2016. The 2016 edition of the Royal Rumble. And by the way, each of these Rumble segments are being archived on the YouTube channel. And what I'll do, maybe after the next one goes up, I'll create a playlist. And so they'll be all organized. Each week when they go up, they'll be organized in a playlist on the YouTube channel. I think that would be the way to go. So we're going to do number 9 this week. That'll come at the end of the show. What will be the number 9 match in the countdown? But first, the Edge and Christian show, for those who don't know, is back for Season 2 on the WWE Network. It's the Edge and Christian show that totally reeks of awesomeness. They had Season 1 of the show, which I enjoyed. I just thought it was just stupid slapstick, you know, comedy, a lot of inside references. Very clear that Vince McMahon has no idea what these two are doing, and that's what makes it so much fun. You get cameos and references on here that you would never see on any of the main WWE television shows. And so Season 2 now is upon us. I watched the premiere. All you need to know is that they had Samoa Joe selling Girl Scout cookies out of the back of his Jeep, and Bray Wyatt is running his own midwife business. I mean, if that isn't enough to get you to start watching this show, I don't know what is. And it aired after Raw Monday night. It was the only good thing about Monday night. I think it airs again after Raw this Monday. So if you are as sick of Raw as I know you guys are, fear not, because they at least have something entertaining that they're producing every Monday night. I do want to mention this. Edge's mother, Judy Copeland, passed away on Tuesday. And Edge wrote a really nice tribute to her on Instagram. Now, he has talked a lot about his mother. She was a single mom and raised him, and she's been to a whole bunch of WWE events over the years. You've probably seen her sitting in the crowd. Anyway, he penned this tribute. I just wanted to read, you know, this to you here. He said, "Today I lost my mom, the only parent I've ever had," which is true. He never met his father. I don't even think he, you know, knew anything of his father, what he looked like or anything. "She was my rock. She never doubted me ever. I wanted to be a wrestler. She said, do it. She scraped together our pennies and kept me fed and clothed and even managed to get me those Kiss action figures and WrestleMania tickets somehow. Because that's what she did. She supported me and bred me to be the man I eventually became. She did her job, but I wish I could, or I wish she could have, stuck around to see the fruits of her labor for longer." And that hit home with me. Because I feel the exact same way about my mother. You just get that feeling that as you kind of go along in life and hopefully achieve bigger things and better things, that they would be around long enough to see it and to enjoy it, because she had such a big impact on him being able to pursue what it was that he wanted to do. And so I can relate to that a lot. So my condolences to him. It really is just one of the worst feelings when you lose a parent, especially a mother. There's just something special when it comes to moms there. So my condolences to him for that. Let's switch gears here. I get emotional about Raw in a very different way than that. Monday Night Raw last week was live from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. There is no Twitter poll. No poll was necessary because this show is a pile of shit. It was a show so bad I went outside in the middle of it to go paint the side of my house. And I don't even own a house. But someone got a free paint job because of this show. Thank you for all the positive feedback, by the way, to the Sound Off Extra rant that I did on this show. I could not hold it in until today. I just couldn't. I said, you know, the way I feel right now, and I've been trying to do more extras from time to time on the channel. It's not like a weekly occurrence, but... You know, I just felt waiting 5 or 6 days just wasn't going to convey the full scope of what I felt about this show. So we had over 60,000 views on the video, and let me tell you something, that thumbs up, thumbs down ratio on that video was about as lopsided as I have ever seen it. Over 2,600 thumbs up, only like 60 or so people voted thumbs down. That tells you everything you need to know. When you can reach a consensus like that on YouTube, of all places, that's telling you something. I called that show in the video, I called it the worst Monday Night Raw of all time. And yes, it makes for a great headline, 60,000 people went and listened to it, but I didn't exaggerate it for that reason. Believe me, I could have come up with headlines a lot more catchy and a lot more sexy and a lot worse for that video than the one I did. I said it because I meant it, because it was indeed the worst Monday Night Raw that I have ever seen. Some people asked me, they said, oh, is it worse than those Triple H Reign of Terror Raws? Yes, even worse than those. I could at least find something I liked on those shows. Is it worse than the Raw from 1997 where they taped half of it from South Africa? That was another god-awful episode. Yes, even worse than that. At least that show had a Stone Cold Steve Austin promo. I would give my left nut for a Stone Cold Steve Austin promo on these shows now. The right one is negotiable too. Is it worse than some of those terrible Raws from 1994, 1995? Yes, even worse than those. Even worse than Mantar and Freddie Joe Floyd and T.L. Hopper. You know why? Because I'll take a 1 hour pile of shit over a 3 hour pile of shit any day of the week. You know, I was reading, there's a great write up on Larry Matisic in this week's Observer. And Meltzer always does a great job with those obituaries. Unfortunately, he's had to write far too many of them. But Madison passed away last Sunday after I had already finished recording the last podcast. He was a mainstay in the St. Louis wrestling scene, former announcer for Wrestling at the Chase. He was a promoter, too. He even worked as the local promoter for WWE for a number of years in the 80s into the early 90s. He, as a side note, opened the St. Louis Wrestling Hall of Fame back in 2007. The guy was a wrestling historian, and he opened the St. Louis Wrestling Hall of Fame back in 07. And I mention this because in its first year, the St. Louis Wrestling Hall of Fame was housed inside the Pro Wrestling Shirt Shop, which was located in the South County Mall in St. Louis. And I know I've told this story on the show before, of being in St. Louis on business. I had a client, they were having a grand store opening inside the South County Mall. And it just so happened to be that year, because I know they moved the Hall of Fame out of the mall the very next year. I don't know where. But I was in that mall, I was getting things ready for the store opening the next morning. And as I'm leaving the mall at night, I walk by this wrestling shirt store. And there's the marquee outside with like an illustration clearly of like Stone Cold Steve Austin. And it says right there, the Pro Wrestling Shirt Shop. And it stopped me in my tracks because I didn't expect to see that in the middle of this place. You know, you fly all the way to St. Louis, to do something completely unrelated. You're walking through a mall and all of a sudden you turn and you see a place like that. If you're a wrestling fan, it's going to stop you in your tracks. And I go in and I see there's plaques on the wall, like in the back, they had the area where the quote-unquote Hall of Fame was. There's plaques on the wall and all sorts of photos and memorabilia of, you know, legends from the past in St. Louis wrestling. And they even had the original ring bell for Wrestling at the Chase mounted on the wall. That was all Larry Matisic. I didn't know that at the time, but that was all him. And I'm glad I got to see that. But anyway, why am I bringing this up? Why am I bringing all the Matisic stuff up? In the obit on him, in the Observer, there is a passage about the local television station in St. Louis, because he gives the whole history on Matisic's career. So this is going back many, many years. And there's a paragraph about the local television station in St. Louis many years ago, getting ready to cut ties with Bob Geigel's group. Geigel was another promoter. And this is what Meltzer wrote. He said, at the time, Matisic found out that KPLR-TV was going to break ties with Geigel's group. They felt the TV shows were terrible and ratings were falling badly. They would send the company letters complaining about the quality of the shows, and ultimately, when the problems were not addressed, made the call to pull the plug. And I immediately thought about Monday Night Raw, and how you could say the exact same thing about that show. Now, it's a very different situation, obviously, because this is a national show, much bigger than, you know, Wrestling at the Chase was, or any of the St. Louis stuff back then. Even on a bad week, of which Raw has had many this year, they are routinely still ranked, if not number one, you know, they're still routinely ranked in the top 10, top 5 of cable shows. Not every week are they in the top 3 or the top 5. So again, it's not exactly the same thing. But I read that paragraph and I just thought to myself, you could make the same exact, it's almost like a mirror image. You could say the same thing about Monday Night Raw. And I thought about that and I thought about how fortunate WWE is that things have changed as much as they have from those territory days, where promotions would be held far more accountable for the product that they put out. If you consistently put on bad television, if your ratings in the local market were falling, were plummeting, or you weren't selling as many tickets to your live events, you would be held to account for it. Today, their only accountability is to their stockholders. And so long as they continue to make money on their TV deals, and on their licensing deals, and on their video game, and all the other ways they find to make money, there's no incentive for them to change creatively. You know, we had Dolph Ziggler on this show accepting Seth Rollins' open challenge for the Intercontinental title. They followed that up with an open forum with Sasha Banks and Bayley. We had an open challenge and an open forum back to back. They should have followed that with an open bar which is what you need these days to sit through an entire episode of Monday Night Raw. So, off to the clips it is for me, at least this week. I know a lot of you don't watch anymore, and you listen to this show to keep up. Don't worry. I got you covered. Don't worry. But every man has his breaking point. Now, Xavier Woods. Xavier Woods had something to say about all of the criticism that WWE has been taking of late. He was over in the Philippines this week doing PR work for the company, and he was interviewed by the leading newspaper over there, the Manila Bulletin. Headline, Xavier Woods slams entitled fans. That was the headline of the article. And he told the paper, he said, when people talk about the difference between the organizations, not even organizations, between NXT and the main roster, so when they like, say, oh man, TakeOver killed it, SummerSlam, this is going to suck, it's the same company, he says. What is there to complain about? Woods said that it blows his mind whenever people complain about pro wrestling shows that they dislike. You just got an awesome wrestling show on Saturday. You just had an awesome wrestling show on Sunday. Then you're going to watch Raw on Monday and SmackDown on Tuesday and then NXT, he said. What are you complaining about? And then, this is what he said. He goes, and then, like, you've got New Japan. You can watch AAA. You can watch so much wrestling from all corners of the world. And it's all awesome. And it's all good. It's all different guys and girls portraying their form of art that they love. And he went on to reveal here in this interview that as a performer, it is painful for him to be criticized when he gives it his maximum effort. He said, so anytime anybody complains about wrestling, it's so annoying to me because people come off as these entitled infants. Because in reality, wrestling hurts so bad. And then we're hurting ourselves to entertain the masses. And sometimes the masses want to tell us how much it sucks. Where do I even start with this? In the article, by the way, the one tweet that they featured, the one video they embedded in this article, was my Sound Off Extra review from that terrible show from last Monday. So I feel it's only right that I respond to this. Thanks for the free press, by the way. Over 700 downloads for the Sound Off in the Philippines in the last 90 days. I was curious, so I checked my analytics. At least I know I have some listeners over there. Look, I like Xavier Woods. He seems like a very intelligent person. He's got a PhD. He runs a successful YouTube channel for his gaming, which is to say nothing of the run that he's continuing to have with the New Day, still going strong now for 4 years now. Almost 5 years those three have been together. I like Xavier, which is why it pained me to read those comments. Not because I was offended by what he said. I don't give a shit. Because I read what he said, and I just kept thinking to myself, well, this doesn't apply to me. He surely can't be talking about people like me. I don't think I'm lumped into that category. Because as smart as he is, even he is not immune to saying something so stupid. That's why it pained me. And I say that because I read this and I thought to myself, what is he talking about? What he is talking about here has absolutely nothing to do with what people like myself have been complaining about. And he's smart enough to know that. And he says it anyway. He is so deep inside that bubble, he may be oxygen deprived. The fact that he takes that as a criticism of their in-ring work and not WWE creative. And I'm not even saying he's necessarily referring to the criticism of Raw this week. He could have been making a general statement. Whatever it was, typically though, this sort of avalanche of criticism that you hear, it's not about the in-ring talent. It's not about the wrestlers, unless they're complaining about Nia Jax, in which case they certainly have every right to do that. But by and large, that's not what they're complaining about. They're complaining about WWE creative. The fact that he took it the other way, he misses the point entirely. This is not a talent issue. Like, I go out of my way, and maybe others don't. I'll just speak for myself on this. But I go out of my way to talk about the fact, as I did, by the way, at the very end of that video I did on Monday. So even there, where I just tore Raw to shreds, I made it a point at the very end to make this point that WWE has the greatest collection of talent anywhere in the world. From Raw and SmackDown all the way down to NXT, the people they've been signing and snatching up, the people at the Performance Center who we even haven't seen yet on television. Top to bottom, the sheer amount of talent they have under contract, and when you look at it, the quality of talent, nobody else ever has had the roster that they have right now. And he's right. There's a lot of great wrestling out there. I've spoken out a lot about that myself. All different products that I've had praise for, not just WWE. More than once this year, I've seen some of the greatest matches that this company has ever produced. Johnny Gargano and Andrade Cien Almas at TakeOver back in January. Best NXT match that I ever saw. Becky Lynch and Charlotte at Evolution. Best main roster women's match in WWE history. We're breaking our backs and people want to tell us how much it sucks, he says. I don't know who these people are telling him that he sucks, but that sure as hell isn't coming from anybody that I know who talks about wrestling. That'd be like saying you can't criticize your favorite NFL team. You can't criticize what your favorite NFL team does or how they play because the players get banged up for your entertainment, so who are you to speak out against these players? They also get paid millions of dollars to bang up their bodies by their own choice, but that's neither here nor there. But just remember, the next time that your team's kicker misses 4 field goals in a game, go easy on him. Don't criticize him. Don't be an entitled brat because he's putting his life on the line for your enjoyment. You have no right to say anything negative. And maybe a kicker isn't the best example to give in that situation, but pick whatever position player floats your boat. You get my point. I guarantee you that there is plenty of guys that Xavier works with, his own colleagues, his own co-workers, who watch football, and they bitch and moan about their teams every single Sunday. How is that any different? If his argument is that you've got all these different wrestling promotions to choose from, why complain about one when you can just watch the others? The old, if you don't like, don't watch argument. Like, I've been a Mets fan my whole life. I'm going to talk about that trade later, by the way, too. But by that logic, I should have given up on this team years ago. But that's not what people do. They want to see their team succeed. They want to see them win championships. They hope they'll be able to right the ship and turn things around. Everything is awesome, he says. Everything is awesome. What is this, the fucking Lego movie? Everything is not awesome. Does he even watch the product? Does he even watch the product? Did the pancake batter get into his eyes? Maybe not. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe he gave up on Raw, like a lot of you did. Maybe he really does only pay attention to SmackDown. Maybe he just goes to work, does his job, and goes home and doesn't even watch. I don't know. The guilt trip, though, ain't gonna work. We're not knocking the talent. We're knocking how the talent is being used. And the way that a lot of these shows are laid out, which is fair game for the fans to do. He calls the fans entitled. Oh, you're entitled if you complain. Yet, he and some of these other wrestlers, not all of them, but there's definitely been others, they just come off as incredibly insecure. You can tell just based on how they act on social media. A lot of them vanity search for their names, and they block people. You know, I have all the respect in the world for what they put their bodies through, but I don't know that I have ever seen so many people who play tough guy on TV for a living act the complete opposite in real life. Some of them are so sensitive about every little thing. The fans have every right to voice their opinion. Just because that opinion might not be, might not jive with yours, or that opinion might happen to be negative, does not make it any less valid. That is their right. They should be able to do so without being made to feel like they're somehow doing something wrong. And I don't expect somebody like Woods to come out publicly and shit on the product at the same time that he's collecting a paycheck from Vince McMahon. I get that. But he also didn't have to say what he said. He obviously did so because he really believes it. And that's the most disappointing thing of all. Clearly, he didn't get his PhD in logic and reasoning. But just remember, the next time that you sit through another unwatchable episode of Monday Night Raw or a bad pay-per-view, if you complain about it, you are apparently what's wrong with the product. You're the problem, not them. Because everything is awesome. So much great baseball out there, I guess I'll just become a Yankee fan next season. Silas Young just signed a new 3-year deal with Ring of Honor. There were rumors of him leaving because he was spotted at that Raw show last Monday night. Apparently he was there because his son is a big WWE fan. I love that there were rumors that WWE might have an interest in signing him. And then right after that god-awful show last Monday, he immediately re-signs with Ring of Honor. It's like, can you blame him? I'd run for the hills too. Also, the WrestleVotes account on Twitter, which does post legit scoops from time to time, they claim that before Roman Reigns got sick and WWE blew up its creative plans for the Raw brand, the original idea for the Dean Ambrose heel turn was for him to cost Seth Rollins the Intercontinental title in a match against Elias. And the only reason Elias was turned, or turned as suddenly anyway as he was because they panicked and they felt like they needed a new face on the babyface side with Roman going down. But I think putting the IC title on him would have been a good thing for Elias. Still could be. There's no rule saying that they can't put the championship on him. Because look, the reality is this Seth Rollins-Dean Ambrose feud does not need to be contested for the Intercontinental title. It really doesn't. So if they wanted to get that championship off of Seth and ultimately get it onto somebody like Elias, or a Balor, or somebody who I don't think are really being done any favors with the booking of Raw lately, I think that would be a fine idea, because Dean and Seth are two people who don't need that championship. This is the product of having Brock Lesnar as the champion. If Brock Lesnar was not, you know, if they didn't currently have on the Raw brand an absentee champion, you know, these are two guys that would be competing for the Universal Championship. You know, maybe not right now, but they would probably build to that. I think there was a very good chance we would have ended up with a Shield triple threat main event, or co-main event, at WrestleMania next year, before Roman got sick. You know, that's where I think ultimately things were probably headed. So, if they get that title off of Seth soon, I think that would be probably a good thing, especially if he is on his way to challenge Lesnar for the championship, the main one, at WrestleMania. There really is no need to have the IC title involved here. Get it onto Drew McIntyre. You know, maybe not Elias. Get it onto Drew McIntyre. He'd be another fine choice. Tomorrow night on Raw, for those of you who are watching, it is Ronda Rousey and Natalya teaming up against Nia Jax and Tamina. Yeah, okay, good luck with that. Wrestling Inc., one other thing I wanted to comment on here, as it relates to Ronda Rousey, there was a report on Wrestling Inc. this week that Fox wants Rousey on SmackDown next year. I don't know that this has been confirmed yet. There was another report a few months ago that indicated Fox wanted less comedy and more of a focus on the athletic and sports sort of aspect of things when SmackDown moves to Fox next year. And again, all of this makes complete sense. You know, they're coming off their deal, Fox is, with the UFC. They want WWE to sort of be part of this sports block that they're going to have at the end of 2019 into 2020 and beyond. They have a 5-year deal here. And so it makes sense that they would want the product to be taken a little more seriously. I know there's even rumors that Daniel Cormier, right, champion from the UFC, big WWE fan, he may well end up as an announcer in WWE on the SmackDown brand at some point. Like, all of these stories and all of these rumors going around, I could absolutely believe that they would want somebody like Rousey to be on SmackDown. She's a huge star still in their eyes. And if they want to tone the comedy down and make it more serious, I think that's the kind of show that Ronda should be part of. So I'd be okay with that move. There's going to be a whole bunch of roster moves that have to be made, though. You know, and let's say if Becky Lynch goes to WrestleMania this year and wins the Raw Women's Championship from Ronda. I know a lot of you probably still laugh at the idea of that, but I think that there's a very real possibility, and I think that would be the way to go. But let's say that Ronda, you know, or Becky rather, does take the challenge up with Ronda for Mania. That would shift her over to the Raw brand. And so maybe you do something of a flip, you know, where you sort of build around Becky as the star of the women's division on Raw. Ronda goes to SmackDown. It doesn't have to be at the end of the year. You could send her there mid-year to get sort of her prepped and ready for the Fox move when SmackDown goes to Fox. I think there are ways to make that work. I know it scares some people, the idea of Becky Lynch being shifted over to Monday Night Raw. It scares me too. But I do think that that's the way to go if the idea here is to have her go to Mania and challenge Ronda for the Raw Women's Championship. I guess she could go and lose and then just kind of sheepishly go back to SmackDown. That's not how I would do it, but you know, you gotta make certain moves sometimes that need to be made and hope and have some faith that they recognize what they have, that she right now is the most, I think, appealing, the most interesting of all the female characters they have on that roster, either Raw or SmackDown. And hopefully they don't squander that. Speaking of SmackDown, let's talk about SmackDown. I want to just thank Wade Keller real quick of the Pro Wrestling Torch for having me back on his podcast on Tuesday to talk about SmackDown Live. We had over 3,400 votes in our Twitter poll. 53% of you voted thumbs up on SmackDown. Only 5% voted thumbs down. 42% said you did not watch. And so, obviously, these percentages are not going to be as high as they used to be on the thumbs up, thumbs down side. Or thumbs up, I guess, because of the didn't watch option. Because the reality is that there are a lot of people who don't watch these shows. You know, and again, they want to be able to vote in the poll so they could not just voice the fact that they're not watching, but so they could see the results. It's better than them voting thumbs up or thumbs down on a show they didn't watch and skewing the results. So 53, when you only have 5 thumbs down, I mean, that would probably be the equivalent of you know, 80 or 90 thumbs up. So an overwhelmingly positive response to SmackDown for what was not an overwhelmingly positive show. Clearly, people were colored by the fact that Raw was so freaking terrible on Monday. It was going to be very, very difficult to put on a show worse than what we saw on Monday. SmackDown was good. It wasn't, you know, best of the year good. But it was an improvement. And SmackDown, by the way, this week came pretty damn close to beating Raw ratings-wise. The show was up 5% over the previous week. It's the man. The man equals ratings. The return of Becky Lynch and an AJ Styles promo. They were the only things promoted in advance for this show going into Tuesday. So you be the judge. Not a lot of good wrestling on this show outside of a you know, pretty good match with the Usos and the Bar. But they started a bunch of new programs. Nakamura and Rusev, clearly they're going in that direction. Samoa Joe and Jeff Hardy, they're moving into a program with those two. And they advanced other existing programs with Becky and Charlotte, with Randy Orton and Rey Mysterio. They've inserted Asuka into what should be the TLC main event for the SmackDown Women's Championship, first ever women's TLC match, which makes it a triple threat, pitting Becky Lynch against Charlotte against Asuka. And I think the chances are pretty good that that's going to end up being your main event, especially with no Brock Lesnar on this show. And you add in the fact that the last time the WWE Championship headlined a pay-per-view, and I don't mean like Daniel Bryan last month wrestling Brock Lesnar in the main event, because that wasn't for the title. But like the last time the WWE Championship was actually defended in the main event, you'd have to go all the way back before WrestleMania to that Fastlane pay-per-view in March. So that doesn't bode well for the chances of AJ and Daniel Bryan being positioned as the main event. Charlotte, Becky, and Asuka is the match that I want to see. It sure as hell is not Ronda Rousey and Nia Jax. I can tell you that. Charlotte, here on this show, did not do anything to earn another shot at the women's title other than beating up Ronda Rousey after their match at Survivor Series, and she beat up the Iconics last week. She really should have been included in that Battle Royal if we want any of this to make any sense, but, you know how that goes. But I'll say this, you know, if anything, it just makes Becky look like a genius. It just looks like Becky was telling, you know, speaking truth to power, because she's been saying for months, right, in the storyline, that Charlotte has had things handed to her. She hasn't earned them. Well, in this case, she's right. She was just gifted another shot at the championship without having really done anything to earn it. So they can sort of play that into the storyline if they want to. I mentioned The Bar, you know, out there for a match with the Usos. The Bar was out there without the Big Show. Remember, we've had the Big Bar for a few weeks now. They showed a vignette, a backstage, not a vignette, but they showed a segment backstage earlier that day in the locker room where The Bar was just yelling at Big Show. Cesaro's putting his finger in his chest and they're yelling at him for, you know, the week before when the New Day beat The Bar. I think it was in the Thanksgiving Feast match and they were embarrassed. And Cesaro is just absolutely furious with the Big Show. And finally, Big Show, you know, he had heard enough of this, and he hauled off and gave a comical, as in comically bad, looking knockout punch to Cesaro. And that was the segment. So that was their way, I guess, of explaining why Big Show is no longer with The Bar. Apparently, Big Show may be suffering from some kind of hamstring injury, so I don't know if he'll be out for a while. I don't know when we'll see him again on TV. This may have been their way to write him out for a little bit. But yet another week, another Big Show turn. I was starting to get nervous, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, it had been a few weeks since I had seen him make a turn. I was kind of thinking maybe he was sick. Maybe there was something wrong. I mean, there's an Edge and Christian show skit waiting to happen. Big Show as a student driving instructor. Turn here. Turn. 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 That's it. That's it. Just nothing but that for 20 minutes. Surely there must be some comedy in there somewhere with this. So I mentioned Samoa Joe. Samoa Joe came out to interrupt what had been a very nice segment dedicated to celebrating 20 years of Jeff Hardy in WWE. They had a video package. I still remember the video package they did on him years ago. What was the name of that song? Lost Prophets, I think, is the name of the group. They did that song, Rooftops. It was a great video many, many years ago. Probably about 10 years ago now. Around the time that Jeff, I think, was maybe challenging for or defending the WWE title. So anyway, they had a nice video, you know, commemorating Jeff's career. They had all the roster, well, most of it anyway, on stage, celebrating as Jeff came out. He did a speech in the ring, and all of a sudden, Joe walks out to interrupt the proceedings, and he walked right by the roster. He's, you know, very sarcastically congratulating Jeff Hardy. He apologized for showing up late. He said, you know, I was backstage popping bottles of champagne. I wanted to make a toast, but I couldn't, you know, bring that out around you, given, of course, Jeff's past problems that he's had. And Shane McMahon is out there trying to, you know, cut Joe off and take the microphone away from him. And Joe just says, you know, that was a very nice video package that you guys put together for Jeff Hardy. It's too bad he wasn't coherent to remember most of it. And Joe talked about how he doesn't like weakness. He hates second chances. I laughed my ass off when he was talking about this. This is coming from the same guy who got, what, 10 different WWE Championship opportunities and failed in every single one of them. This guy doesn't like second chances. That had to be a rib. And anyway, he ended up walking out. Jeff challenged him to a match. Joe walked out. So this is the next program, probably a match at TLC. I can get behind this. I can get behind this. First of all, Joe, they've got to do something very quickly to just make people forget about what we've seen with Samoa Joe, because they treated this guy like an absolute, complete freaking joke. And, you know, what happened at Crown Jewel, they had to come up with a championship alternative. Daniel Bryan didn't want to fly over, so they just put Joe in there, and he just lost again. It's fine to lose a match, but when you lose match after match after match, you come out there talking like a tough guy, and it's the Bray Wyatt thing all over again. Bray Wyatt was known for what? His promos, right? And even people didn't necessarily think those were particularly good. They got kind of boring. But he would, you know, he was a talker. And he would talk about all these devious things that he was going to do, this evil, creepy guy he would come off as. And you remember that video that somebody on the internet, and God bless whoever it was, they put that video together. Actually, I think it was a listener of the show. That's really how that whole thing started. They actually put a video together, tweeted it to me. I tweeted it out, and it ended up catching fire. But I think it was a listener of this podcast who put this hilarious video together of Bray Wyatt every single time he would cut a promo. You know, before his feud with John Cena, or before the Royal Rumble match, I'm going to go in there and eliminate, you know. And then they would immediately cut in footage of him losing, or they would immediately splice in footage of him being like very casually dumped out of the ring at the Rumble. When you see it in those when you see it in that form, it really hits home how much they've used and abused Bray Wyatt to the point where he just means absolutely nothing. I mean, him being a midwife in that Edge and Christian show skit was the best thing they've had him do probably in years. What does that tell you? That was the most entertaining that he's been in years. I would fully endorse at this point a stupid gimmick like that for him. It can't be any worse than what they had him doing. So, you know, you talk about them dropping the ball on Bray Wyatt, and you don't have to be a big Bray Wyatt fan. You may not think he's even that good. You may not even like a lot of his matches. But character-wise, they completely sabotage the guy. And Joe, it's almost like the Bray thing all over again. He comes out, there is no one better at trash-talking right now on the mic in this company than Samoa Joe. Like laying the verbal smackdown on his opponents. There's nobody better than Samoa Joe. Talking, he's got that down to a science. But then he goes out there and he loses. He gets embarrassed. He can't back it up. After the third, fourth, fifth time, people stop believing in all your bluster and all your promos and all your tough talk. It doesn't mean anything anymore. So the best thing they can do for this guy is to just put that in the past, forget it ever happened, and very quickly pivot and have him come out and start just destroying Jeff Hardy on the microphone and tearing him to shreds and trying to make people forget about the feud with AJ Styles, because that did no favors to Samoa Joe. But I'm reminded of a feud that Jeff had about a decade ago with Umaga. And Umaga was kind of built the same way that Samoa Joe was, right? Now, forget the fact they were Samoan or whatever, but, you know, just even physically speaking, they're very similar. People used to joke when Joe would keep re-signing with TNA, oh, he should come to WWE, and people, oh, they're not going to know what to do with him. They're just going to call him Joe Maga and put makeup on his face. I think people were only half joking when they said that. I always thought they would bring him into the company and just call him Bazooka Joe or something like that. Do they even make Bazooka Joe gum anymore? That used to be a thing when I was a kid. You'd buy like a baseball card or something and it would come with a piece of Bazooka Joe. You'd have the little comic wrapped inside. I don't even know if they do that anymore. But anyway, Jeff had a great little program with Umaga. Some of the matches they had were really, really good. Those two had really good chemistry. So, and Umaga was a brawler. He was a brawling type. I'm hopeful that Jeff and Joe maybe could kind of rekindle some of that magic that Jeff found with Umaga. I know it was a long time ago, and he's a lot older now. But I'm looking forward to seeing what these two can do. They ended the show. They had a qualifying battle royal for the TLC main event with the women on the SmackDown roster. The woman who was the last person standing would be added to the championship match at TLC, which is a TLC match between Becky Lynch and Charlotte. Did they need to add somebody to this match? Did that match really need a third wheel added to it? It didn't. However, Asuka picked up the win here in this battle royal. Another person, used and abused, chewed up and spat out by the SmackDown writing for much of 2018. She's been on the back burner. She's been dancing. She's been mocked for her accent in backstage segments. All the things that you would think not to do with someone like Asuka, they have done with her. And somehow, she has maintained her popularity. To her credit. To her credit. She continues to come out and get big reactions. If they have a segment where the entire roster is lined up together in the ring and they call each person out, they introduce each person one by one, every single time Asuka gets the biggest reaction. Asuka comes out, she gets a nice reaction from the crowd. They haven't completely destroyed whatever it is, whatever appeal it is that she took with her when she left NXT and came to SmackDown. So it came down to her and Sonya Deville. She eliminated Sonya, Asuka picked up the win. And now it will be Becky, Charlotte, and Asuka for the championship at TLC in 2 weeks. Now, my first thought is, well, clearly Asuka is in there to kind of take the losing fall. But then you realize that if it is under traditional TLC rules for a championship match, they've had TLC matches before where you can win by pin or submission. But when there's a championship involved, it's traditional ladder match rules. The championship is suspended above the ring, and the only way to win is to climb up and retrieve the title. So if we are to assume that this match is following the same rules, Asuka's not going to be in there to get pinned. She's not going to be in there to be made to submit. We'll find out. I mean, look, maybe they're going to change things and change the rules. But if they don't, she's not exactly in there to take the losing fall, per se. But I do think that in a way she is, because however they're going to work this finish, I don't think it's just going to be straight up, you know, Charlotte knocking Becky off the ladder and just winning the championship. It could be a case where, you know, Becky is down and, you know, Asuka somehow is the one to be knocked off or bumps into Becky or something like that, that, you know, gives an excuse to say that Becky Lynch didn't exactly lose clean. Because I think, if you were to ask me now, what do I think is going to happen here? What do I think should happen? If I had to make an early prediction and tell you what I would do, I know some people will be upset about this. But I think the way to go here is to get that championship off of Becky and put it on Asuka, and not put it on Asuka, but put it on Charlotte. Get the championship off of Becky. Maybe there's a big table spot or something. Becky is down. It comes down to Charlotte and Asuka. And Charlotte ends up winning the women's championship for what? The eighth time, I guess it would be. Eighth time, ninth time. Why would I do that? Well, because I still believe very strongly the pathway here is to have Becky Lynch throw her name into the hat in the Women's Royal Rumble and have her win the Royal Rumble. Have her eliminate Nia Jax to win the Royal Rumble. Charlotte is the SmackDown Women's Champion, which means, by the way, at the Rumble, you can now do champion versus champion, have your rematch from the Survivor Series, Ronda Rousey seeking revenge on Charlotte, non-title, big match, right? Big rematch between those two. We could talk about what the finish would be, probably not having a decisive finish, but that's a big match to do at Chase Field at the Royal Rumble. Meanwhile, Becky wins, and Becky now can choose. I don't think there's going to be too much drama in who she would choose, but there would at least be some. She could choose Charlotte and try to get back the championship that she feels maybe she never really lost. Or she could choose to go to Raw and challenge Ronda Rousey for the Raw Women's title, which is exactly what she would do. That's the pathway that I like on the road to WrestleMania. And then you could do Charlotte Asuka 2 for the championship, the SmackDown title, at WrestleMania. But to do that, she's got to lose the title first. And there's a way to do it without it hurting her at all. It doesn't hurt her. It doesn't kill her momentum if she loses the championship in a way that people think maybe is not exactly the most fair way in the world. Case in point, the people who like to make comparisons between Becky and Stone Cold, right? Which, again, I think is overblown. But, okay, let's take Stone Cold Steve Austin as an example. Here's a guy who had crowd support. He had a lot of momentum behind him. Look at all the times. Austin never had a long reign as champion. He was champion 6 or 7 times. I'd have to go back and see what the longest stretch of time was that he had the championship for. Because I don't think it was very long at all. You look at the first time he won the championship in 98. He lost it to Kane only, what, 3 months later? Won it back, held it for another 2 or 3 months, lost it again. Won the championship back at WrestleMania 15, dropped it 2 months later. Won the championship back on Raw, dropped it 2 months later. So on and so forth. My point is, when Austin dropped the championship, he got screwed over by Vince McMahon, Undertaker and Kane. Remember the whole double pin at Breakdown? That led to the Deadly Game Tournament. And, you know, Austin was in the position to chase. They felt that was the right position for him to be in, not to be champion going into WrestleMania, but to be the one chasing for the championship. And that was the right move to make. I mean, now that I think about it, I guess the longest run Austin would have had probably was in 01. Probably, right? Because he held that title from WrestleMania all the way to Unforgiven, I think it was. You know, but you didn't have Stone Cold having the title like AJ Styles did for a year. They wanted Austin to be in the position to chase. He was screwed, and now people badly wanted to see him win that championship back. And you could apply the same logic here. Becky does not have to be the champion going into the Rumble or going into WrestleMania. You could build to her winning the championship there. There's nothing wrong with taking the title off her here and putting it on Charlotte. Watching football is fun, but it's more exciting when you've got some skin in the game. Doesn't matter if you're an expert or a rookie, you need to be betting at MyBookie. Pick three teams to win, and if you hit all three, you could turn $100 into $600. There's so much to bet on: college basketball and football, the NBA, the NHL, even esports. You name it, MyBookie has it. They've been in business for years, they've got great reviews online, and their mobile site is easy to use. Sign up this week and MyBookie will give you a 50% deposit bonus to jumpstart your bankroll. Also, make sure to follow them on Twitter at BetMyBookie. They personally respond to every mention in DM, not to mention they've given away more than 10 grand in free money to their followers this football season. Don't miss out on one of the best weeks to bet on sports all year. Log on to MyBookie right now and use promo code SOLOMONSTER to get your 50% deposit bonus. That's promo code SOLOMONSTER. My bookie. You play, you win, you get paid.
Let me remind you, and I think a lot of people here will agree, NXT is way better than the WWE.
Former NXT Women's Champion Kairi Sane tweeted that she was diagnosed this week with hand, foot, and mouth disease, which is very contagious. Usually, though, it disappears on its own in about a week. It is a disease that kids usually get before the age of 10. You don't usually see it in adults. I know this because I got done reading about it over the summer when Noah Syndergaard was placed on the disabled list with it for the Mets. As if the Mets haven't dealt with enough injury issues these past few years, we end up with a pitcher getting hand, foot, and mouth disease. Yeah, maybe in spring training, Robinson Cano, since he's coming to the Mets, maybe he'll end up with smallpox. That sounds about right. NXT this week was taped from the campus of San Jose State University. That is where I actually saw my very first NXT show live, WrestleMania 31 weekend. I don't think they ever showed that show on television, but I remember the opening match, Hideo Itami hitting the GTS for the very first time on Tyler Breeze. Place went nuts. Oh, what might have been with Itami had he not gotten hurt. EC3 was back in action for the first time in a month. I believe he was dealing with a concussion or concussion-related issues. He beat Marcel Bartel, and he then cut a promo on Bobby Fish, blaming him for the storyline knee injury that kept him out for the last month. He vowed revenge. You know, EC3 is one of these guys who I fear is just going to end up like Bobby Roode if he ever gets called up to the main roster. Like, physically, he's got a better look than Roode does, that I'm sure Vince McMahon would love. And he is younger than Bobby Roode was when he first came over. I don't think his wrestling is his strong suit at all. EC3, I don't think, is known for being this great wrestler. He's got charisma. He's got a good look. He's got charisma. And if he's not allowed to show off that charisma the way that, like, I feel Roode wasn't allowed to show off his charisma either, the way he did in NXT. And I do think EC3 works better as a heel, much like Bobby Roode, then he's going to be dead in the water. I hate to say it, so I fear for his future. If I were him, I would hope that I get to spend the next year in NXT. But I guess the problem with that is they have so much talent now stockpiled down there. Unless you can really break through into sort of the upper elite of that in NXT, I don't know what his ceiling is there either. You know, do I see EC3 one day as the NXT champion? I don't. I really don't. But I also fear what will happen if he ever gets called up. It's kind of this weird, damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, although he probably is better off in NXT. We got our first vignette promoting the debut, or as Matt Riddle would say, the debut, of Dominik Dijakovic. Or I guess it's just Dijakovic now. There was no mention of a first name. They're not even bothering to wait for Vince McMahon to get a hold of this guy and chop off his first name. This is the former Donovan Dijak from Ring of Honor. Feast your eyes is his catchphrase. He is a very talented guy. If you saw him in Ring of Honor, you already know that. He's going to do very well for himself in NXT. He got over good, too, in that one match he had with Ricochet on NXT television a few months ago. I think it was back in May. It was just a one-off thing, and he got over pretty well there. So I see big things in his future. And he's a big guy, too. You know, he's very lanky, but he's tall. I think that'll work to his advantage. Mia Yim got a win over Vanessa Bourne with what they called Eat Defeat. Now, I know that's what the move is typically called, but Mia, when she uses it, at least in the Mae Young Classic, they called it Soul Food. I like Eat Defeat better myself. I believe Snitsky does as well. Main event was the Battle of the Hosses with Mia's significant other, Keith Lee, taking on Lars Sullivan. Talk about weird relationships. You know, we had news leak this week that Aleister Black recently got married to Zelina Vega. And you got Keith Lee together with Mia Yim. See, all these interesting relationships going on here in WWE Developmental down there. Could build a whole reality show around it. Actually, I hope to God they don't do that. These guys will probably end up on Total Divas or something when they get called up to the main roster. First time that we have seen Keith Lee get a real challenge here at NXT. He challenged Lars Sullivan. And in this match alone, Lee, who is every bit of 300-plus pounds, hit a flying crossbody. He hit a corkscrew plancha out to the floor and a moonsault attempt that did not connect. That is impressive. Not impressive enough to win. Sullivan hit the freak accident and pinned him. I don't think Sullivan lost here, not just because they want to keep him strong for his main roster call-up, because there were some people who didn't understand why would they do this, right? We know Lars Sullivan is coming to Raw, or he's coming to SmackDown. Why beat Keith Lee here? Why have Keith Lee lose to somebody who's on their way out? I don't know that he is necessarily on his way out just yet. I don't think that Lars Sullivan is done yet, even once he debuts on television. I don't think he's done yet in NXT. And there have been a lot of guys that have spent time finishing up in NXT, you know, long after they've already made their debut on Raw or SmackDown. Kevin Owens was the NXT champion when he debuted on Raw, and he had already beaten John Cena once and then lost to John Cena once before he even dropped the NXT title to Finn Balor on that Beast in the East show. So Keith Lee losing here didn't bother me, especially if we end up seeing a rematch between them. This match was good enough. I enjoyed this more than I thought I would. I wouldn't mind seeing a rematch. I don't know if they can hold out, you know, for one until the next takeover. Maybe they could just do one on NXT television at the next set of tapings or something. But yeah, I don't think Sullivan is done just yet. I think before long, Keith Lee might get a win over him before he leaves. I watched both episodes of NXT UK this week for the two main events. First, we had an NXT United Kingdom Championship match with Pete Dunne defending against Jordan Devlin. This was great stuff. Dunn went for the bitter end, but Devlin countered that into a reverse Rana. He spiked Dunn just headfirst down into the mat, right on his head, got a close near fall. Later on, he hit Dunn with the Super Spanish Fly off the top rope for yet another near fall. He yanked the mouth guard right out of Pete Dunn's mouth. He gave him a super kick. There was a moonsault by Devlin. Dunn caught him on the way down in the triangle. And then with Devlin down, he began to pry his fingers until Devlin just could stand the pain no more and had no choice but to tap out. Over 560 days as UK champion now and counting for Pete Dunne. Second episode had the finals of the NXT UK Women's Championship Tournament. Tony Storm taking on Rhea Ripley. Now, this match was taped back in August, and at the time, it was reported that Tony Storm had suffered an injury, a back injury, possibly a spinal injury of some kind during her match here with Rhea. It turned out not to be as serious, thankfully, as people originally feared it might be, although she did have to pull out of a whole bunch of indie bookings that she had been booked for. So, if you watch this match very early on, when she goes for the hip check into the barricade outside the ring and Rhea moves out of the way, Tony goes ass first into that barricade. That looks to be where she first got hurt. She was practically crying after that. She was having trouble standing up. Then she gets up on the apron. This was even more brutal. She gets up on the apron with Rhea, goes for Storm Zero, the Tiger Driver that she does. And instead, Rhea backdrops her, Or she goes to backdrop her onto the apron. And Tony barely hits the apron. She more accurately clipped it on the way down. It looked brutal. So if she wasn't hurt the first time, she was most definitely hurt on that spot. Referee rushes over to check on her, and she says she's okay enough to continue. And so they incorporated the injury into the remainder of the match. In fact, it played into the finish. She went to go hit Storm Zero. Her back gave out. She couldn't do it. Rhea hit the Riptide Slam and pinned her to become the first ever NXT UK Women's Champion. A lot of stunned faces in the front row when the referee counted three. They did not expect Rhea Ripley to win that championship. Tony was, you know, she was winning the Mae Young Classic, so, you know, it wasn't really that big of a deal that she lost here. And they clearly see big things in Rhea Ripley's future. Look, I mean, she's progressed a lot in the last year over what we saw from her in the Mae Young Classic the first time out. You know, between her performance here and in the Mae Young Classic this year, the match with Tegan Nox, where Tegan, you know, her knee basically exploded. And, you know, Rhea had this look of, you know, she didn't panic. She didn't cry. She didn't go over to show concern for her opponent. I'm sure she was very concerned. But she played it cool. She had this look of just complete lack of remorse on her face. She played it off well. She has picked things up very quickly. Second time, by the way, this summer alone that Rhea has had to deal with an opponent being injured in a tournament match. And both times, it wasn't her fault. Tegan did a dive in her match, landed wrong. And here, Tony threw herself into the barricade and hurt her back. It's not Rhea's fault. You know, and look, maybe the plan all along was to incorporate a back injury into this match. Maybe that was the story they were going to tell anyway. But she was hurt. Thankfully, now she's fine. The match probably suffered because of it, because this went less than 10 minutes. I have to think they planned to go longer, I hope. You know, I think back to her match with Io Shirai. It was Tony and Io at Evolution in the finals of the Mae Young Classic. That match only went 10 minutes too. Maybe it's just a matter of them having to have a little more faith in these women to go longer than 10 minutes. You know, it was good. I just thought it could have been better. And I'm guessing the reason they've been doubling up on these NXT UK shows is to play catch up, because they were so far behind in the tapings. Now that they got this tournament out of the way and everybody knows that Rhea Ripley is the champion, we'll see if they continue to double up on these episodes or if they just go back to the one episode format. WWE signed Walter this week, big independent name from Europe. He wrestles for the WXW promotion in Germany. He also wrestles for Progress, which has a working relationship with WWE. He's been PWG champion. They've had their sights set on him for a while now. What's interesting is that he appears to have no interest in being on the WWE main roster. Smart man. Smart man, this Walter is. He gave an interview to The Mirror back in September and said, "Being part of the Raw or SmackDown roster is nothing I am interested in. I don't want to live in the US. I really like NXT, though. I think it's a great product filled with the best talent in the world." And supposedly New Japan made him an offer as well, but he turned them down because he did not want to move to Japan. He did not want to go on long tours in Japan. This is a man that likes his home and wants to stay there. I respect that. He really does want to stay put where he is. And so WWE, you know, gave him what he wanted. I assume this means that he's headed to the NXT UK brand. You know, they have their first UK takeover show coming up next month. So maybe we'll see him waving in the front row on that show. In that same interview, he really put over the NXT brand as a whole. So I suppose they could fly him in to work as a special attraction on some of the main, you know, takeover shows. Like they did with Liger. Remember, Jushin Liger came in that one time to have the match with Tyler Breeze. So they could do something like that. I haven't seen too much of his work, to be perfectly honest with you. I've seen a few matches, but not enough of it to form like a great opinion of him. I know I would never want to take a chop from him. That much I know. I would not want to take a knife-edge chop from Walter. I don't think that would be a fun day for me. But speaking of signings, this sort of dovetails into something else I wanted to talk about here, which really is a big story, and it got a lot of coverage, I know, in The Observer and maybe in some other places, and it's definitely worth mentioning here. There was a big report, actually, in The Observer this week talking about the situation with the NXT UK contracts, and something that really was inevitable from day one when this all got started, which is that WWE is no longer allowing its UK contracted talent as of January 1st to work for promotions that they are not currently partnered with. WWE has been forming partnerships with certain indie promotions in the UK and beyond. And they have been preparing for this day. Now, apparently the talents are being paid currently. Their contracts, those UK deals, maybe not for the very, very top of what they would consider the top stars there, but the contracts have ranged from anywhere from $20,000 to $25,000 a year, which is really nothing. But they were allowed to wrestle elsewhere to supplement that income. So they had this guaranteed, let's say, $25,000 salary coming in from WWE. In the meantime, they could still book their own shots and work, you know, shows and other promotions however many times a week that they saw fit. So I'm sure they were still doing well, even though the money from WWE wasn't really that great. Now, many, not all of them, but many of them are going to be getting raises of how much I don't know. But with those raises come these new restrictions. And the lower level guys, I take it, who do not get raises can continue to work elsewhere. But this would not apply to probably a lot of the names that you're thinking of, like a Pete Dunne, or, you know, maybe a Wolfgang, or Trent Seven, Tyler Bate, people like that. Now, the report also says that the UK wrestling boom has cooled off quite a bit this year, business-wise. Not necessarily in terms of the talent that's being produced and all that, but just in terms of business. The thought was that the exposure on the WWE network for a lot of these UK stars would have led to greater recognition, to greater overall interest in seeing them. And apparently it's led to the exact opposite for a lot of these groups that operate out of the UK, just in terms of ticket sales. And ticket sales are really the lifeblood for a lot of these promotions. You know, it's obviously a lifeblood for WWE as well, but they make so much money in so many other ways that it's actually not as much of a priority for WWE as it would have been when they were living and dying based off of ticket sales, let's say back when business was soft in the mid-90s. It would have meant a lot more to them if they were doing, you know, thousands of dollars less in ticket sales than maybe it would today. Although you need to fill those seats up. You know, people don't want to watch a TV show that has, you know, half-empty stands. You know, that's not a good look either. But a lot of these promotions, they live and die based on how many tickets they're able to sell. And apparently this year there was a big fall off from the way things were last year. Now, I don't know that you can lay that all at WWE's feet. You know, overexposure was probably bound to happen no matter what. I remember many years ago reading that there was, for whatever reason, a big wrestling boom in Italy. And I still to this day don't know what to make of that. But there was a period of a few years where at least WWE, maybe not independent wrestling, but WWE was hot as shit over in Italy until it wasn't. One day it fizzled out and I haven't heard about any sort of WWE boom in Italy now in many years. So there is something cyclical about it, I guess. There is, you know, the risk of overexposure when you have so many different promotions. But I take it, though, that things have not played out the way that most people would have hoped that it would with this exposure from WWE. Pete Dunne, in response to these reports, he felt the need to sort of, I guess, defend WWE. He tweeted, "British wrestling is safe. Will continue to grow. The talent pool is deep. Your favorite wrestlers are achieving goals and taking steps in their career. Don't believe everything you read. Brit wrestling is alive and well. Without the hard work of myself and countless other wrestlers with the goal of signing to a major company, there would be no thriving UK scene to begin with. Support independent wrestling and support independent wrestlers as they take the next steps in their career." You know, for guys like Pete Dunne and Trent Seven and Tyler Bate, it's great because they're getting paid more and they're getting exposed to the WWE audience. You know, Dunne is someone who could absolutely, I think, succeed on Raw or on SmackDown. Maybe not with the people currently running the show, but I think that the idea of Pete Dunne being on the main roster at some point, even though he's a smaller guy, he's a guy who I think could get over. I really think that he could be a star on Raw or SmackDown. Not 205 Live, not NXT or NXT UK. He could at some point, he's still young. There's still plenty of time. He's only 25. But he could get to that level where he could be a legit star on the Raw roster or on the SmackDown roster. If he was pushed and wasn't sabotaged by Vince McMahon. But like he said, they're achieving their goals, they're living their dream, and that's great for them. But it is going to hurt a lot of other promotions. That's just an unavoidable fact. He can talk about, hey, support British wrestling, and that's great. That's a great message to send. But there's going to be promotions that get hurt by this. Especially now they're not allowed to use certain guys, or you can use them, but you can't, you know, put them in the ring with somebody who's under contract to Impact or Ring of Honor or New Japan. All of a sudden, it makes it a lot more difficult for these promoters to book these guys on their shows. And look, it's going to hurt you if you don't get into bed with WWE. If you don't learn to kiss the ring, you are going to be hurt in some form or fashion. It's just the way it is. Now, what I found most fascinating in this report is this little nugget. Part of WWE's working agreements originally offered and agreed to. So this is for the promotions they're partnered with. Forget the ones that they're not partnered with. This is for the ones that they are partnered with. Part of the condition was that WWE would have the right for the next several years, if they chose, to purchase the companies for an agreed-upon price and then shut them down. So they would no longer compete, quote-unquote, with themselves. With the idea that that would only happen when they were at the point that they could run a full-time schedule themselves in those markets. Look, we knew this was going to happen. I said this on the show almost 4 years ago. There was a long-term vision here that Triple H had to effectively take over the independent scene. If there's one thing that WWE loves, it's to be in control. They need to be in control of everything. Look at the contracts that they have their talent sign, independent contractors. They are in full and total control over their own talent, supposed independent contractors. Give me a break. They have to be in control of everything at all times. Now we read about their plans every week, it seems. They want to recreate the territory system, but on a global scale. They want to open performance centers in different parts of the world. They want to open one in Germany, maybe the UK, maybe Saudi Arabia. They want to run or partner with someone to run for them their own local promotions, basically, in different parts of the world, like the UK. You need to play nice and play by their rules. Buying out companies, only to eventually shut them down so they can run their own shows, is exactly the sort of thing that you would expect them to do. And some of those top stars are going to benefit from it because they'll get paid very well. They may not have to travel all over the place as much. But for some of these smaller promotions, and for the fans who maybe would enjoy seeing some of these big, you know, European indie stars wrestling other big stars from New Japan or AAA or other, you know, companies, they lose out because that's just not going to be allowed anymore. Not if you're under contract to WWE, it's not. So there's pros and cons, you know, as with everything. But if you thought that WWE was just going to sit back and enjoy peace and harmony with everyone and sing Kumbaya, well, I think most of you were smart enough to not actually think that was going to happen. But this is only the start of it. They're going to continue to expand. We may see some of those UK promotions even end up on the WWE Network next year if they move ahead with those premium tiers that they polled everybody on with those surveys. And that'll be good if you're progress. That'll be good if you're ICW. For everybody else, maybe not so much. But right now, it's the UK. Soon, it's going to be Germany. Eventually, I guarantee you, it'll be Japan. It may be Mexico or Australia. You know, 30 years ago, Vince McMahon wanted to take over the entire country. Now, Triple H wants to take over the world. There's a reason he calls all of his big shows TakeOver. He hasn't exactly been subtle about it. Time for the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I mentioned the Mets earlier. May as well address this first. Dave from Arizona and all the people on Twitter who have been asking me. He's got a Mets question for me. Xavier Woods is not going to like my answer. He wants to know, with this big trade the Mets just made, is it finally time to be excited? For those who don't know, the Mets have agreed to send, and this is all pending physicals, so this could all fall apart, but they have agreed to send Jay Bruce, Anthony Swarzak, who is a reliever for them, and prospects Jared Kelenic, Justin Dunn, and Gerson Bautista. to send them to the Seattle Mariners. Now, Kelenic is one of the most, he would be the one, I would say, prospect-wise, that people are most excited about in the Mets organization. Realistically, he's probably 3 years away. But they're trading away their top pitching prospect and one of the top position players in their farm system. In return, they're getting Robinson Cano to play second base, who was suspended for 80 games last season after getting popped for PEDs, and is, I think, 35 or 36 years old now. And closer Edwin Diaz. Diaz hopefully will be a solid addition. They're also getting $20 million, the Mets are. Originally, I was reading they would be getting $50 or $60 million. $20 is quite the come down from that. You know, I'm torn. On the one hand, I want them to win now and not later. You know, you get tired after a while. We're gonna build for the future. We're going to win in 2, 3, 5 years. I don't want to win in 2, 3, 5 years. I want to win now. Right? Isn't that the fan mentality? I don't care about 5 years from now. I want to win now. So, on the one hand, yeah, I want to win sooner than later. And with prospects, there's never a guarantee of anything. Look, Kelenic can turn out to be a stud, or he could turn out to be the next Lastings Millage. Or Fernando Martinez. Mets fans know those names very well. But Cano's 36, coming off a PED suspension. Got a 5-year deal now. That contract is going to be an albatross for this team. But then again, this is the same team paying 55-year-old Bobby Bonilla $1 million a year until the year, like, 2035, I think it is. So they're not exactly known for their great deal-making skills. They got one of the best closers in baseball, and they didn't have to give up Jeff McNeil. He was another name that was rumored to be in the mix. They didn't have to give him up among all the prospects. So it wasn't a complete disaster. It's not like we're getting nothing for it. But I still think the deal is, and maybe I'm being a little nice here, but I think the deal is very much a mixed bag. Chris from Texas, there has not been much speculation as to who will be facing The Undertaker at WrestleMania, seeing as how Shawn Michaels is not interested in another match. Well, he says that. I would not close the door on one more Shawn Michaels-Undertaker match. I'm not saying I would want to see it. I'm just saying I wouldn't rule him out for WrestleMania. However, it got me thinking of potential opponents, and I believe I speak for many when I suggest AJ Styles. AJ held the WWE title for over a year. He can make anybody he goes up against look good. I believe he is a worthy and suitable opponent for The Undertaker. What do you think? I agree. You know, if Undertaker is going to keep doing this, he needs to be in there with guys who can carry the load. AJ can certainly bump his ass off for him. I think he'd give Undertaker at this stage probably as good a match as anybody else on that roster would. I think Drew McIntyre could be another option if they wanted to keep this story going of him putting down legends, make him like the modern day, legend killer. He put down Kurt Angle, he could put down The Undertaker at WrestleMania. I would rather they do something better with McIntyre. So for me, yeah. You know, if he's not competing for the WWE title, I would probably go with AJ as my first choice, too. Kirill from Moscow, Russia. 5 years. He has been listening to the sound off, so what's up to Kirill? My question is about Kevin Nash. Throughout his career, Nash has been criticized by a lot of people, including wrestlers like Ric Flair, for having almost zero talent when it comes to his in-ring abilities. Even though Nash has always looked at wrestling as just a source of making money, I can't say that he has no talent at all. Can you name the three top matches of Kevin Nash's career? You know, I've heard Ric Flair say that before, he didn't say that Nash has little talent. He said Nash has no talent. I think it may have been on one of those old Legends Roundtable shows that WWE used to do. That is a very stupid thing to say. Of course, Kevin Nash had talent. You know, he was never going to be wrestling circles around anybody. And he definitely ended up in the lucky sperm pool. 7 feet tall, Vince took one look at him and probably saw dollar signs from day one. You know, a big man in that company is always going to get more chances than a little man will. That's just the way it is. I still think that's true even today. It might be truer to a lesser extent, but that's just because there aren't as many big guys in the company. He used to be a big man's company, and it would be rare to find guys, especially guys they would push, who were quote-unquote normal size. It's very different today than it was, 30 years ago. But I still think the same logic applies when it comes to Vince McMahon, that if he sees a big guy, whether he's tall or just jacked to the gills or whatever the case may be, you know, his eyes probably bug out of his head. That person is going to get more opportunities than most people would. But to say that Nash had no talent is ridiculous. And I'm sure Ric Flair has forgotten more about wrestling than I'll ever know. You know, 40-some-odd years in the business. It's still a stupid thing to say. Even if he had to be in there with guys far better than him for him to have a really good match, you still need to know what you're doing in there. You need to be able to work. Got to remember, Nash was hanging around with guys like Shawn Michaels and Scott Hall and Sean Waltman back at in the mid-90s when he first came in to WWE. Either he was watching them work night after night after night, or he was working with them, he was working against them. You know, it's hard not to pick up by osmosis, if nothing else, you know, a few things from those guys and at least be good at what you're doing. Nash has had a bunch of memorable matches that are worth going back and watching. In fact, I just rewatched the match that he had with Bret Hart at the Royal Rumble back in 1995 because I'm doing this top 10 countdown of all the, you know, the greatest Rumble title matches. So I wanted to go back and rewatch them all before I ranked them. Now, I won't spoil if that match ends up in the countdown, but, you know, I will say it was not any better or any worse than I remember it being. And I think that he and Bret had a much better match at Survivor Series later that year. That I would say that Survivor Series match in 95 would be one of the three best matches that Nash ever had. I also have to give praise to the first match he had with Bret in their trilogy. I wouldn't put that in my top three, but definitely deserves some recognition. Unless you count the cage match, you know, that they had in 96 before WrestleMania, I guess technically that would make four matches. But I look at it really as a trilogy, starting with their King of the Ring match in 94 for the WWF title. That was the infamous Art Donovan show. That was the first, I think, truly great match of Kevin Nash's career. That was actually a really good match that probably is what convinced Vince McMahon to put the championship on Nash later in the year. Like I said, not one of the top three that King of the Ring match was, but definitely worth a watch. The No Holds Barred match with Shawn Michaels and Good Friends, Better Enemies is the best match that Kevin Nash ever had. And if I had to pick a third one to round out the top three, there is a really underrated tag team match that he was part of back in 94. It aired on a show called Action Zone. It used to air on the weekends, I think Sunday mornings on WWE television. I remember when Todd Pettengill and Doc Hendricks used to co-host it together. It aired on Action Zone. It's actually included on, I think, a couple of different DVDs, but there was a DVD dedicated entirely to the Click that WWE put out a few years ago. I know it's on an old Coliseum video. I think it's called Slam Jam or Slam Fest or something like that. It might be on the network since they have a bunch of Coliseum videos up there. But it was Diesel and Shawn Michaels against Razor Ramon and the 1-2-3 Kid. Track that match down and watch it if you've never seen it. It is a really, really good match. I would say Diesel probably, you know, did the least work of the bunch, but he was still part of that match. And I think it's absolutely one of the best matches that he was ever part of. So, you know, if you want me to rank them, I would say third place would be that tag team match. Second place would be the match with Bret at Survivor Series in 95, where Bret takes the table bump and Nash turns heel at the end. And number one has to be the No Holds Barred match with Shawn Michaels at In Your House. Dave from Vienna, Austria. Another international listener here. Since you touched on the decline of business following WrestleMania X7 a few weeks ago, factors being the lack of competition, as well as the Austin turn, combined with the lack of credible babyfaces, I want to know which of these three hypothetical scenarios would have had the best chance of perpetuating the wrestling boom, in your opinion. Mind you, all of them would take place immediately after the Rock-Steve Austin steel cage match on Raw the night after WrestleMania 17, which ended with The Rock being beaten down by Stone Cold, Triple H, and Vince McMahon. So here are the three scenarios that Dave is pitching here. Number one, the NWO, Hogan, Hall, and Nash, invade as an equilibrium to the two-man power trip, so they would have been invading basically a year earlier than they did. and I take it they would have been the babyfaces. Option two, Goldberg debuts. So that would be, let's see. Well, if Goldberg would have debuted after WrestleMania 17, I mean, that's a full 2 years, right, before he actually debuted in WWE. And option three, Bret Hart returns to settle his score with Vince McMahon and rekindle his feud with Steve Austin. I think any one of those three scenarios would have done great business. I think the Austin turn was going to hurt them no matter what. But I've said before, they really screwed themselves by doing that, because Rock was leaving right after WrestleMania. They had to know that he was leaving for a few months to go film one of those Scorpion King movies, I think it was. Maybe the first one that he did. But they had to know he was leaving. And yet they went and they... I know Austin vouched for it, so they went and they turned Stone Cold heel. And so all of a sudden, in one fell swoop, you have now lost your two biggest babyfaces in Stone Cold and The Rock. And the original plan, I believe, the original plan was for Triple H to turn babyface after he lost to The Undertaker at WrestleMania that year. He turned babyface and he would be the one to go chase Stone Cold for the championship. Triple H vetoed the idea. He didn't like that idea because he probably knew that in the end he was going to lose to Austin. Probably didn't want to lose to him. And he opted, hey, I know what. Let's team up. I'll be partners with Stone Cold. I'll be on the same level with him. And so they did. And what that did was it left them with Kane and The Undertaker as their two top babyfaces. And then after that, it was Chris Jericho and Chris Benoit. Great wrestlers. I don't know that you would be building around them as the two top babyfaces in your company. Then Triple H got hurt. Then they bungled the invasion angle. It was one misstep after another. If Austin turns, but all of those other things don't happen, you plug in one of these scenarios that he's pitching here, and I think they're a hell of a lot better off. Like, I wouldn't go with the NWO in that spot, because that just would make them babyfaces, and the NWO invading as babyfaces to me just doesn't work at all. Bringing Goldberg in as the top babyface to go through Triple H, let's say, on his way to the big dream match with Stone Cold for the championship, maybe at SummerSlam that year, that would have been huge. That would have been huge. That match would have done tremendous business. Would Goldberg coming in as the top face have been better for business than Bret Hart coming back as the top babyface and getting revenge on Vince McMahon? Probably. Probably, because Goldberg was a bigger star at his peak in WCW than Bret Hart ever was in WWE. And I say that as a big Bret Hart mark. I mean, he didn't have as long on top as Bret had, but Goldberg had a popularity, I mean, truly, that was matched only by Stone Cold at that time. Bret Hart never had that. But I can sit here, you know, as a Bret fan with a straight face and say that, you know, Goldberg was more popular and meant more to ratings and buy rates and such than Bret Hart did. If I'm the promoter and I'm looking for another, call it a boom, call it whatever you want, I bring in Goldberg and have him murdering dudes as he goes through Triple H to get to Stone Cold. If I'm a fan, now that's my promoter hat. As a fan, me personally, I would have wanted Bret to come back because he never should have left to begin with. He had no business being in WCW. They had no idea what to do with him. And the idea of him coming back for revenge on Vince, yeah, look, maybe have it where Linda McMahon, it comes out that Linda McMahon signed Bret to a deal to come back as a way to spite her husband. This would have been perfect timing. This was right after WrestleMania, where Linda was in that catatonic state. And then she woke up and she kicked her husband in the dick. So the timing would have made sense. Linda signs Bret to come back to the company again, you know, without her husband even knowing. He's going to come back and make Vince's life a living hell, and then rekindle his feud with Stone Cold for the championship. Bret and Stone Cold had some tremendous matches together. So if Bret's healthy and he comes back to the company, the idea of him and Austin having a couple more pay-per-view matches, hey, sign me up. That's what I would have wanted as a fan. But if I'm answering your question from a business perspective, it's door number two. I think you got to go with the Goldberg option. Tony from Sacramento, let's just say that if Shawn Michaels went to WCW while Bret Hart was there, would WCW have revisited the Michaels-Bret Hart feud? I don't know. This is a company that brought Bret Hart in after the screw job and made him a referee. You know, I don't know that. Look, you want my honest answer on that? Would they have revisited Bret and Shawn? I think it would have been impossible for them not to, but I think every single force behind the scenes would have conspired against it to try to make sure that it did not happen. Because Bret versus Shawn is not a mid-card feud. That is a main event level feud. Do you honestly believe that people who no doubt had power and influence backstage at the time, a certain someone who loved to come out and pose with a feather boa, you think he would have stood for that? You think he would have stood for a Bret Hart Shawn Michaels feud in WCW without injecting himself into it in some way? That's to say nothing of other people, I'm sure, who were playing politics at that time, whether it's Nash or people like that. Everybody had their own self-interest. Everybody was looking out for themselves. Bret was the new guy. Shawn had his buddies there. He would have been protected. Who'd Bret have? A bulldog? Anvil? What friends did he have? You know, would WCW have revisited the feud? I can't say for sure that they would have. I mean, you would think it's a no-brainer. But I think with the politics being what it was, there would have been people looking to sabotage that thing before it even got off the ground. And if it did, if they did rekindle the feud with Bret and Shawn, boy, I would feel sorry for Bret. Because he would have no protection in that feud. It would not have ended, put it this way, it would not have ended, I'm sure, the way that Bret would have liked for it to end. This is from KC. I was watching an episode of Raw from June of 98 on the WWE Network. Headbanger Mosh was supposed to play this new character known as Beaver Cleavage with his big-breasted mom. During an interview with Michael Cole, Beaver was scheduled to wrestle Meat. This is ridiculous. Wrestling is fucking weird. All right, so Beaver was ready to wrestle Meat, a.k.a. Sean Stasiak. 30 seconds in, Beaver says, "No, I can't do this." He takes off his hat and he walks out. You then hear a woman in the background yelling, "Chaz, we're live," and then JR and King come back and tell us that there's some creative differences going on backstage regarding Meat and Beaver Cleavage. This match will not be happening. It was all really confusing and awkward. Do you have any insight into this whole Beaver Cleavage nonsense? And was that interview a work or a shoot? Actually, I think you're a year off. I think the gimmick was from 99, not 98. But the way it all came about, you know, as I always understood the story, is Gerald Briscoe used to say that Mosh's passport photo, driver's license or passport photo, looked like Beaver Cleaver from the old 50s TV show. And so I guess people backstage, maybe as like a rib on him, they started picking up on it. They would call him, Beaver. And the Beaver Cleavage gimmick just sort of came out of that. You know, Vince Russo and creative, they all got together and they conspired to come up with this gimmick. His tag team partner, Headbanger Thrasher, was out. I think he had a knee injury, so he was out of action. And they were just trying to come up with something for Mosh to do in the meantime. So they paired him off with this busty blonde to play his mom. Shockingly, this did not last long. I know, right? Surprising. Who could have predicted that something like that would happen? But the segment that you asked about, it was planned. It was meant to be a work shoot. They obviously realized how stupid it was. And the next week, he came out under the name Chaz. Chaz became his new gimmick. He didn't fare much better with it. I got to interview the Headbangers last year. It went swimmingly. And Geronimo from Salinas, California. Do you think WWE would ever give Draws the Warrior Award? They should give me the Warrior Award for having to watch Raw every week. I deserve the Warrior Award for next year. But no, I don't think they would give it to Draws. They tend to give it to people who they can get, you know, a lot of publicity out of it, right? They give it to a celebrity. They give it to an athlete. They give it to a sick kid. Draws doesn't really fit into any of those categories. So, no, I don't think they would do that.
It's time to rumble! It's time for the Royal Rumble!
This week, we are down to match number 9 of 10 as we continue our weekly top 10 countdown of the greatest championship matches in Royal Rumble history. I've gone through all of these matches. I've assembled my own ranked top 10 list last week. Dean Ambrose and Kevin Owens was the number 10 match in the countdown for the Intercontinental title, last man standing at the Royal Rumble in 2016. This week, match number 9, is one of the more infamous matches in WWE history. It's a match that I really debated whether or not to include in the top 10 because it had been many years since I had watched it. And I remember thinking the finish sucked and I thought it went way too far with the violence. It's a tough match to go back and watch. Even today, especially when you look at how carefully the company, you know, treats even the hint of a possible concussion. But when I did go back and I watched it again, I remembered that these two were actually having a pretty good fight, pretty good brawl, until things just got way out of hand. It is the I Quit match between The Rock and Mankind for the WWF title. Royal Rumble 1999 in Anaheim, California. You know, when I think of The Rock's greatest rivals, the first name that comes to mind is Stone Cold Steve Austin. That goes without saying. The next name I think of is Triple H. They both became headliners around the same time, both around the same age. They had a lot of matches together, great chemistry, very competitive, clearly, with one another. So then I think, well, who's next? Who would Rock's third greatest rival be? And that's where I think of Mankind. Before the Rock and Sock connection, these two had some wars together, going back to the late 98. Rock beat Mankind in the finals of the Deadly Game Tournament at Survivor Series to become the corporate champion. They did the Montreal finish from the year before, where Mankind never actually gave up. Vince McMahon called for the bell. They followed that up with a terrible match in December of 98 at the Rock Bottom In Your House pay-per-view with one of the stupidest finishes that you will ever see. Fast forward to the January 4th episode of Raw, which was taped the year before. Technically, it was taped the year before. Mankind won the title with an assist from Stone Cold. Still the biggest pop that I have ever heard or seen on television in my entire life. When Austin's music hit, when the glass shattered, I think that were they in Boston that night or Lowell somewhere in Massachusetts, and the place just erupted. And Mankind was the beneficiary of that. He won the championship for the first time that night. That was the night Eric Bischoff told Tony Schiavone to spoil the result on Nitro and make the famous butts and seats comment, and then something like 600,000 people decided to switch over from Nitro to Raw. Oops. That led to this match. Michael Cole and Jerry the King Lawler had the call. Jim Ross was off television recovering. This was his second bout with Bell's palsy. I think he was backstage that night coaching Michael Cole. So I think he was there, but he just wasn't on TV. But just imagine, like, if you had Jim Ross on the call for this match, like when Foley goes flying onto those giant electrical boxes, or at the very end of the match when Rock is just bashing his brains in with that chair. I mean, Michael Cole did a respectable job, but he was no Jim Ross. But this was pretty entertaining. You know, if you remember The Rock back then, he would talk trash during his matches. He'd grab the headset. He'd yank the headset right off the announcer's head, and he would commentate during his own matches. Here, there was a spot where he placed the ring bell right next to, you know, Mick Foley's head. He started ringing the bell all the while. He's singing, "Bells will be ringing." Then he waffles him upside the head with it. So we got a lot of that from The Rock here in this match. Rock went for a rock bottom on top of the announce table, but the whole thing just collapsed early. Not the last time that would happen to The Rock in a championship match at the Royal Rumble. Same thing happened in his match with CM Punk. So they brawl down the aisle, and this is where Rock, he props up a ladder up against the wall. He climbs the ladder up into the stands. Foley climbs up after him. Now, Foley is on the ledge. So Rock is in the crowd. This is above sort of where the entranceway is. And Foley is on this very narrow ledge. And they're exchanging blows, and Rock delivers a right hand, and that sends Mankind flying down onto the giant electrical boxes, I guess the breaker boxes. Probably, I would say, a good 5 foot drop. Knowing them, they would call it 15. But he did land hard. He landed right on top of this giant, you know, box, and he bounced off it, landed on the floor. The lights went out. We saw sparks fly to make it look like things are short-circuiting, and the lights, like I said, in the arena went out. It was a great spot, visually. Very great spot. Shane McMahon came out. He was trying to convince Rock to just stop. Rock was not interested. So he fought with Foley back down the aisle into the ring. In the ring, he brings in a pair of handcuffs. And he cuffs Foley's hands behind his back. Foley is defenseless. Rock just starts wailing away with punches. Foley gives him a low blow. He starts kicking the Rock. He's fighting back. He's got no hands. He's fighting back. Rock knocks him down. Puts a chair across his head. Gives him the corporate elbow. Smashes the chair down into his face. At this point, Rock tries to get Foley to say the words, "I quit." And Mick tells him to go to hell. And it's like watching a movie where the good guy gets captured. Like, let's say you're watching a movie, there's like a terrorist attack or something. And the terrorists capture the good guy. And instead of just telling the bad guy, telling the terrorist what he wants to hear, the good guy spits in his face. You would watch that and just shake your head and say, well, bad things are about to happen. Rock says, okay, you first. Picks up the chair. And this is where things just got way out of control. Now, as Foley tells the story, Rock was only supposed to throw 5 chair shots. Okay? 5 swings with that chair. That was what they had agreed upon. Throw 5 shots at his head. Rock got carried away. He hit Foley double that. He hit Foley in the head with that chair 10 times. Dead in the head. First 2 shots were brutal enough. Then he asks Mankind if he wants to quit. Foley says, "You'll have to kill me." And he almost did. The next 4 or 5 shots that followed that were fucking disgusting. Mankind, he was... Now, Foley seemed to be egging him on. Foley was coming back at him. He wasn't selling those first few shots. He's like, "Come on, come at me." And it just looked like Rock got carried away. He's like, "Okay." And he just wailed away and wailed away until finally Foley fell. And he rolled out of the ring. Now, his head was already bleeding. He was already bleeding under the mask. So Foley was already busted open. You could see the blood. Rock hit him a few more times outside the ring. Foley circled around the ring, and now he's walking very slowly down the aisle. It's like he's trying to leave. And Rock, on that last shot, that 10th and final blow, Rock didn't even bother to wait for him to turn around. He just shellacked Foley with it. Right across the back of the skull, and down went Mick Foley. Then came the finish, which was a recording. Foley never actually said the words, "I quit." Rock put the mic in his face. Foley's hair was sort of obstructing. You couldn't really see his lips moving anyway. But what they did was they played a recording of Foley saying the words, "I quit," from a promo that he had done earlier in the night on Sunday Night Heat, which was very apparent to anybody listening at that time. That qualified as a win, I guess. It was stupid. The finish was stupid. But at least it was over. The match was finally over. Michael Cole was screaming how The Rock makes me sick. Even Jerry Lawler. Jerry Lawler was always, you know, the heel, and he agreed. You know, things went too far. He goes, "All right, I'll admit, things went too far." I will say this. It gave Rock an edge. They could have done this in a lot of other ways that didn't, you know, risk this guy's life. But what this did, as vicious as this was, this gave Rock an edge that he did not have before. Here's a guy who's going to go on to challenge Stone Cold, defend the championship in the main event of WrestleMania. You know, they did a lot of funny stuff. Rock had a lot of funny catchphrases, but we had not really seen the truly vicious side of him until this match. This match really drove home, you know, what a, just an uncaring, he came across as the most uncaring, vicious son of a bitch on the planet in this match. And so that was one of the, I guess, positives, one of the benefits of it, at least as far as Rock is concerned. But what made this worse was the fact that this is when the Beyond the Mat documentary was being filmed. They were following Mick Foley, Terry Funk, and Jake Roberts around. They were kind of the three featured performers in this movie. WWE had given their camera crew permission to film whatever they wanted, and in the movie, some of the most powerful footage in the documentary is of Foley's wife and kids in the crowd watching on in horror as Foley is just bludgeoned to death with those chair shots. You know, his daughter Noelle is in there. She's crying to the point where his wife, in the middle of all this, has to collect the kids and walk out. They can't take it anymore. And Foley, later on, he realized how incredibly stupid it was for his kids to be sitting 10 feet away from him as he was getting his brains bashed in. When he watched the footage back from Beyond the Mat, he said he felt guilty. He felt like a bad person. He said he never wanted to see his children like that ever again. And Foley was also very upset with The Rock for a while. It took a while before they kind of patched things up and everything was cool between them. He was very upset with The Rock when the match was over. A, because they went beyond the number of chair shots that they had agreed to before the match. And B, The Rock never bothered to check up on him backstage when the match was over. Foley had to go find The Rock, not the other way around. And that really bothered him, that Rock just did not seem to give a shit. He just didn't seem to care. Now, Rock did come back out later in the show for the finish of the Rumble match. He had to help distract Austin. He helped eliminate Stone Cold from the Royal Rumble. So his work that night wasn't done. But, you know, come on, dude. Like, it would have taken 10 seconds for him to go ahead and check and make sure that Foley still had a pulse. Kind of reminds me of Austin being upset at Owen Hart. Owen Hart never bothered to call him and check up on him after Owen dropped him on his head at SummerSlam. I'm not sure they ever patched things up. I don't know that things were ever really right between those two ever again after that. I know Austin was very upset about that. But Rock's reign with the championship would be brief. They would continue to play hot potato with that title. If you remember Halftime Heat, which honestly, Halftime Heat is one of the more fun matches that the company's ever done. It was an empty arena match, and Vince McMahon actually did commentary for a good part of it. We had Vince back on commentary for the first time. And I guess at that point, Vince was probably, what was that, early 99? So the last time Vince did commentary probably was the fall of 97. So it had been a while, but that was a fun match. Again, kind of a very goofy finish where Foley lowered this pallet down on Rock and he couldn't move and basically pinned him with it. So Foley won the championship back. They had a last man standing match at the St. Valentine's Day Massacre pay-per-view. That went to a draw. Another dumb finish. Then they had a ladder match on Raw the very next night, where, remember, the Paul White, the Giant, Paul White, he had debuted the night before. I think he factored into the finish and cost Foley the title. Rock won back the championship and then went on to WrestleMania. And Mankind actually officiated the final minutes of that match at WrestleMania between Rock and Austin. So, for a period there of a good, I'd say, what, 4 months, 5 months, Rock and Mankind, they were just attached at the hip, these two. They went back and forth. By the fall, they were tag team champions. And that's where they did the whole This Is Your Life segment for The Rock, which did unbelievable, you know, numbers. But this I Quit match, I would put this I Quit match in the same category as Foley's Hell in a Cell match with The Undertaker in this way. In that, it is horrific to go back and watch. I feel guilty, in a way, going back and watching it. But if you made a list of the all-time great Hell in a Cell matches, you wouldn't leave that match off. Like, that might not be your favorite Hell in a Cell. You might not think that that's the best Hell in a Cell. Like, I don't. I think the best Hell in a Cell ever, still, is the first one between Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. But I would not be foolish enough to make a top 5 or a top 10 or even a top 3, probably, and leave off that Undertaker-Mankind match. You know, yeah, it wasn't a technical masterpiece, but it wasn't supposed to be. It was a spectacle. You would not leave that match off that list. Because wrapped in all of that violence is a great brawl that told a story of a guy who absolutely, positively would not quit. Same thing here. The I Quit stipulation, like Hell in a Cell, it's an inherently violent stipulation. It is supposed to make you uncomfortable. I don't see how you can do a list of I quit matches and leave this one off. It's not as good as the other, you know, 8 matches that I've ranked ahead of it that I'm going to be rolling out over the next 8 weeks. But I do think it deserves a spot in the top 10. So that's my rationale for including it here in this list, in my list, why I put it here at number 9. And yeah, so next week, we are moving along in the countdown. We're going to be doing number 8. And we're counting down until the number 1 match, which should coincide that Sunday of the Royal Rumble in 2019. That's when the countdown will finish up. And so anyway, let me know what you think about the I Quit match. I know there's a lot of divided opinion about it. Some people don't like it. Some people may think it's just a terrible match. I didn't think too much of it until I went back finally and I rewatched it. And like I said, I can appreciate it for what it was until things just, you know, just went way too far. And Rock came away like a big badass, even though the guy had his hands cuffed behind his back. I don't know how much of a badass you could be when you cuff somebody's hands behind their back. But like I said, he got a violent, nasty edge to him coming out of this match that he did not have before. You know, Foley had a knack for that sort of thing. I will say, you know, he had a, you know, that street fight with Triple H in 2000. I never looked at Triple H as being a main eventer until he stepped into the ring with Mick Foley in Foley's own environment. And it changed my opinion of him. So Foley, I think, if anything, probably doesn't get enough credit for the things that he did for some of those people's careers on their way up, on their ascent. Everybody looks at him, oh, he's the hardcore guy, and, you know, he had those hardcore matches, and the bump off Hell in a Cell, Mr. Socko. Like, there's certain things people associate with Foley, but I think one of the things you need to associate with him is what he did for the career of The Rock, what he did for the career of Triple H, and probably others, too. If you have questions, again, you can keep sending them in to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @solomonster. On Instagram, it's thesolomonster. For the people who have asked, I mentioned this a few weeks ago on the show, if you wanted to send items or somebody wanted to send me like a holiday gift or something, there is a mailbox set up for anybody who wanted to ever send something. The address is 223 Bedford Avenue, B-E-D-F-O-R-D, 223 Bedford Avenue, number, so the pound sign, 1121. So it's not a P.O. box or anything like that, just put number 1121. That's in Brooklyn, New York, 11211. Thank you again for all of the feedback that you guys left on that Sound Off Extra Raw review. I got into a lot more detail, heated detail, in that video than I did here on this show. If you want more full thoughts from the show last Monday, I don't know why you would, but that's the video to go check out. Please subscribe to the YouTube channel if you have not already done so, as more extra content, unannounced, goes up like that. Unless you're following me on Twitter or Facebook, the only way to know about it is to be subscribed to the channel. So please go ahead and subscribe there. I will be back next weekend, that I believe is December 9th, for episode 576. Of the podcast as we slowly wind down 2018 and head into the new year. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and I will see you back here for more Sound Off next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
Mundo goes to leave, and Taya says, wait, aren't you going to put any pants on? He just goes, no time for pants. And he walks off. That also happens to be Randy Orton's philosophy in life. My philosophy, too. You see, you don't know if I'm wearing pants right now or not, do you? You can't see. I could be wearing nothing right now for all you know. No time for pants.
Solomonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.